Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking, meet some of the characters involved and dig deep to find out how they do what they do. I'm going to keep the intro real simple this week and we're going to give you an opportunity to win a brand new bike and support the World Cancer Research Fund at the same time. Cancer is a horrible disease and it's already impacted way too many of my friends and family, but thankfully some great people have come together and put together this opportunity to win and to help cancer research at the same time. So Cotic Bikes have teamed up with Hope Technology, Wilderness Trail Bikes, Cane Creek and Madison, along with some support from O'Neill Clothing for a runner-up prize. And they're going to be giving away a top-spec Cotic Rocket. It's absolutely beautiful, top-end kit, XTR, all that kind of stuff. You can win it. It's only £5 to enter. You can enter as many times as you like if you want more chances to win. And it's pretty easy to do. All you need to do is go to justgiving.com and search for Cotic, and you'll find the Cotic Rocket raffle there. Or you can head to justgiving.com/fundraising/Cotic Rocket raffle, all one word, and that's the direct page. But the easiest way, just go to justgiving.com, search for Cotic. Like I said, £5 to enter. You can enter as many times as you like, and all the money goes to a great cause. We'll also put that link in our show notes, which is over on our website, downtimepodcast.com. You can pretty much find anything you want on the website. So if you want to subscribe to the podcast, if you want to follow us on social media, if you want to shop for a t-shirt, all there on the website, just head to downtimepodcast.com. Okay, this week's guest, probably the hardest one I've had to pronounce so far, but I'm going to give it a go. It's Thesa Rojo from Uno Bikes. Thesa has been in the sport for a long time. He was a World Cup downhill rider with some pretty special results. He's been the Masters World Champion, and also one of the guys that was involved in the very early days of longer, slacker bikes. He's going to tell us hopefully a bit about that. I'm going to ask him about his thoughts on the really long bikes that we're seeing and why people are adding weight and things like that. We're going to talk to him about carbon fiber and why that's his material of choice. A little bit about data acquisition and timing data versus feel, and some of the comparisons to MotoGP. Plenty of stuff to talk to him about. Super interesting guy. So sit back, relax. Hope you enjoy it. Here's Thesa Rojo. Thesa Rojo, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. So we're clearly going to talk about engineering at some point, and I'm excited to get into that with you. But before we do that, let's just talk a little bit about, you know, how riding came into your life. So tell us a bit about how you got into mountain biking and maybe more specifically into the downhill side.
Well, I guess I started like any kid, like riding a bicycle for just like one of those things that your parents give you when you have a certain age. But at some point, like I really was enjoying a lot. I lived outside the city, so it was a town, so it was easy to go anywhere with your bicycle. So we started going to the mountains with friends, and we saw this race happening, like where we usually ride, a downhill race, and I thought it was really cool and exciting. So like we went more into like riding in that track, and I guess one thing took another, and then I felt like, I would love to race, and my parents also liked me to do like a sport, so I, you know, have something to focus on. So it was really like, you know, pretty casual, but and I started taking it very, very easily, but I have to say that after a couple races, I started doing quite good, so I then put more serious work on it and start training and do the proper stuff, and one thing led to the other. And after 2 years, I kind of become professional, even if I never stopped studying during my career in racing. I always was studying either in high school or university, but I would consider I was for some years pro, I would say.
Yeah, so you ended up on Martin Whiteley's team, Global Racing, with some pretty big names at the time, I guess. So alongside Greg Minnaar, Missy Giove, Mick Hanna, Matti Laikkanen, it must have been an interesting team to be on.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was pretty good years. That was basically my my last team and my first, I would say, proper pro team. First time I had a mechanic to work on my bike. Before that, it was always me. So, yeah, but the team was really cool, and what Martin did was amazing, and I had really fun and my best results ever. But unfortunately, yeah, the team like had to stop, and I used that kind of excuse to focus on studying. So I think I retired with 20 or 21 years old, so not too old.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, and you had, was it a sixth place at Leger, or was it higher?
Yeah, that was my, let's say, last proper race I did. I finished sixth and 11th overall that year in the World Cup. So
awesome, yeah. So you're at the sharp end of it. So like you said, in parallel to that, you were studying in the background and obviously working very hard at that. What attracted you to engineering in the first place? Why was that a kind of a path that you decided to follow?
Well, I think, you know, since a kid, I always liked it, how things worked, and I was intrigued by that. So like how to make things. And since I like got my first bikes, and I was always like taking things apart and playing. And then when I started racing, I was even like taking the fork apart and playing around and like trying to improve things and changing bolts. And, you know, so I think I was always interested of that. Also, my dad was involved always with motorcycles. So, you know, I guess when you move around that type of things like motorcycles, cars, bicycles, probably engineering is something that comes interesting to you because all those things are really related to that. So I think that was what started my motivation really to do engineering.
Yeah, and how did engineering and bikes come together then?
Well, I mean, it came already when I was in Global. I was already starting. I was on my first year or second year. I don't remember. I think it was my second year at the university, and we had some issues with the bikes at that moment. And I had a couple of ideas. I passed over to the Orange guys, and it solved the problem on the bike. So from that, also when I had like time or whatever, I was designing bikes. We even put a couple of crappy bikes together that I designed with the guys at Orange. Like they it was really cool because they made the bikes, but even if they were a bit shitty. But that was my kind of my first project while I was even in the university. So everyone was doing like a small project of whatever, as small as possible. So, you know, like didn't have to work too much. And I was doing a full bike for whatever stupid project. So I was always looking for an excuse to design something related to bikes. And I always had that interest. So always looking and trying to learn about how to make a bike, a suspension, how it was working. So it was really like, yeah, I mean, it was a passion with my studies that also was my, so it was like my hobby and what I was seeing as my career, like they were joined with the, or connected by the bicycle.
Yeah, awesome. And I think the first time I came across your name in an engineering context with Mondraker, so you were behind the forward geometry, which I guess was kind of the start of, you know, longer, slacker mountain bikes, really. How did you get involved with that?
Well, with Mondraker, so when I finished the studies, I started doing a couple, like freelancing a couple things and stuff like that. And then a friend of mine, he's a journalist, and he is really close to the guys at Mondraker. And basically they asked me if I would be able to like make something for them and to help them to have their own suspension system. So I started working in a suspension system for them, and we just did like a mule to try it out. And that was kind of a test, like, okay, let's see if this guy can do something for us. And we did the mule. They were super happy with it. Like it worked really well. And I think from there, you just like start progressing, like, okay, let's try to make a one bike. And then after that, turn more into like I wanted to hire a designer to try to make things prettier. And we start moving from there, but it really started with the Thera suspension, not actually with the forward geometry.
Okay. So it was a suspension design before it, became the kind of the overall layout. Okay. And what led you to that, you know, that longer, slacker geometry? What was going on in your head that made you think that was the right way to move?
So
was it just a series of experiments?
Yeah, this was probably, I think, like 2011, something like that. It was before a race, like I did the Transparence race I did. And basically, what happened there is that I was seeing like the pros riders for downhill, like riding bigger size bikes, like longer. So jumping one size up because everyone was looking for more stable bikes and I guess, basically more stable bikes. So my idea was, okay, can I do something like that, but not just for downhill, for anything else? So I talked to the guys at Mondraker and said, what about if we take an extra large bike and put a medium seat tube on it and I'll give it a go? And so they were happy to do that. And we ordered one bike. I started trying it and really like made the bike way more aggressive and more stable. And, you know, it was this kind of new bikes. And in fact, after that, I went to race the Transprovence race. And in one of the most technical stages where it was really rough and difficult, I beat pretty much everyone except the two local guys that they were racing in the backyard. That was Nico Buio and Fabien Barel. But like Jérôme Clemens, everyone else, like I beat them in the most difficult. And I think big part of it was the bike was so much advanced to what everyone else was riding that it helped a lot there.
Is are you able to explain what it is about that longer geometry that helps through stuff like that? Is it purely a stability thing?
Yeah, it's definitely like, I mean, have in mind that bike, it's not as long as actual Mondrakers nowadays. It's closer to what it's like the Uno we have actually it's in between a medium and a large. So that bike, I still have it in the office, the very first bike, and it looks like a normal bike nowadays. But if you compare it to what it was back in the day, and I remember the faces of the people when I was there in Transprovence, like, what the hell are you riding? This thing is super long. It's so crazy. Can you turn with this? What's going on? But if you look now it looks more like a normal bike, but it's just like, this was, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. So it's been a long, a lot of things happened in this time, but still that bike probably nowadays is a pretty decent geometry. So
And do you know where the head angle was roughly on that?
No,
as well?
The head angle was nothing different. We were stock, I think it was 67. Okay. So the head angles in the end in Mondraker, they were never too extreme. They're always pretty conservative. They still are. They're nothing too crazy. I think they never went to the, or we never went, and I was never in favor of that extreme Fabien Barel head angle. We definitely did a big change in downhill as well when the Mondraker, the Summum came off, as every downhill bike was pretty much 66, 65 degree head angle, the slackest ones, and we went with 63. But we never went more crazy. The thing is, we went to that geometry in 2009, and that geometry still is like a good geometry in 2018. It hasn't changed. Yeah. So we were really the first ones I had this vision of the actual geometry that pretty much settled down nowadays on downhill.
I remember it being launched and kind of couldn't get my head around it, but now it all makes sense. But it took me a long time to work it out.
If you look now, that geometry, the head angle, change the length, whatever, it's pretty normal. It's like nothing crazy on it.
So is there a way to ride these longer bikes? Like, do people kind of have to think a little bit differently about how they ride? Are you kind of keeping your weight more central and moving around less?
I want to make something clear maybe before that, because I'm not in favor in like Nikolai or Geometron or Paul cycles. I think that to me has passed and crossed that line way too far. What we did. Okay. It was a bike that is what we similar to what I have now with Uno, and that was for me the perfect balance. And basically before designing the or before opening the molds, carbon fiber molds for the Uno bikes, I was testing a lot of different bikes, like normal sizing bikes and extra long bikes and something in between. And what I found out really is that the super long bike, it's kind of, it's good if you're really going for a time and like really pushing for it and like really focused to go like really fast. But then it becomes like really slow bike. Like if you want to whip, if you want to manual out of a corner, it's not a fun bike. So my thought when I was designing the geometry for the Uno is like, okay, we really want to make a, let's say, boring bike where you're not able to play around and jump and manual and bunny hop and stuff like that and make like whips easily. Or we just going to pure to something that needs to be stuck in the ground. And so really I went back and forward and my feeling was that, and what I see now is a lot of guys like really leaning towards the super long, super slack bikes. And my feel is like they went into those bikes, they got used to them, and they jump for 1 or 2 days in a normal bike or just one day, a couple runs, and it's like, oh, a short one feels too short. But that's normal. You got used to something, and the same thing happens the other way. You go now from your normal bike jumping a long one, it's like, oof, I cannot ride this thing. But after a week riding it, it's just perfect. The problem is when you go forward and backward, like one day on one day on another, you never get used to one. You definitely feel like the short, a bit, let's say, shorter, not shorter, like in between the normal and the super long. I think it's a perfect balance. And to me, those guys like just went too far. And I think it's a couple perfect examples out there where you would see actually no one that has gone to super stream long bikes has done better in downhill, for instance. There's not a single long bike doing good. In fact, one rider, I won't mention it, but he was on a super long bike on some of the World Cups this year. He switched for a shorter bike from another brand, and he did his best result ever by far, just by switching into a normal sizing bike. And just look at the races. There's no one really on extreme long bikes. No one. Not a single racer.
You think there's a sweet spot then maybe that you get the benefits of the stability, but you don't lose the other elements.
In enduro, there's not a single enduro guy doing good on a long bike. There's not a single downhill rider doing good on a long bike. One thing is to go to your local trail with no pressure, with no nothing, and focus into put a good time on your long bike because you want to demonstrate to everyone else that your long bike is faster. A different story is to go to a race and do good with that bike. And that hasn't happened yet. And there's a reason for it. So I understand that the long bike feels you very stable. But if you go down a trail with a tandem, it's going to feel more stable. You would be able to pretty much go down a wall without the back wheel leaving the ground. But that doesn't mean that's faster. Yeah, you're more comfortable and you're like, you don't care. Like you can go through everything because the bike just doesn't move. Or if you put like 50 kilos on your bike, it will be stuck in the ground. Because this is another thing people are talking like to put weights on the bike to make the suspension work better. Of course, it's going to work better. Because if the bike weighs 5 kilos or 50 kilos, when something hits in the ground, it's not the same to go against 50 kilos or 5 kilos. It goes against 5 kilos, more goes to your body. But if it goes against 50, less goes through it. So, and the perfect example is if you imagine you throw your bike without your weight, like let it go down a trail with rocks. It will just be start jumping and the suspension almost won't move. You do the same thing with a motorcycle and we'll keep attached to the ground because the motorcycle is 100 kilos. So it's like if a rider and a half is on top of it. So that doesn't mean that the suspension is working better. I mean, it's working better, but just for the weight, but the suspension works the same way. It's just that you put more weight on top of it. So putting weights is not a solution, really. It's okay. just fixing so, a problem so in a way. It's better fix it with a better suspension system.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. That makes a lot of sense. So we talked a little bit about the UNOS side of stuff. I was gonna ask you about that. I think we've covered a little bit of the philosophy behind UNO, but tell us a little bit about how UNO came to be and what you wanted it to be.
Well, I mean, with UNO, basically things started when things start to cool down a bit with Mondraker. So I really wanted to really feel part of a brand and to be able to do the things I was able to do with Mondraker, that they left me pretty free to do whatever I wanted. So that was super cool from them. And I really appreciate like the confidence they had in me to do all the crazy stuff with it in the past. But I felt that that started stopping and I didn't have that much freedom anymore. So that was the point where I decided I want to have that freedom and to be able to do things as I felt about it. So, and that was the point where UNO started, and it definitely a big part of it is also like to make it local, to employ people from here, and basically to learn more about the process. So for me, it's always big part learning. It would have been much easier for everything to made in Asia. We would be able to sell cheaper bikes. We would be able to probably have all the bikes already in the market. Like everything would have been so much easier if we went to Asia. But to me, it was a part of making things locally, employing local people, being way more environmental friendly company by doing things here. We're able, like we're recycling the material, like all the carbon fiber. We're doing a lot of things, and for the next year, we're trying to see if we can connect to a new company that they're doing here in Barcelona for electricity that runs on green energy and stuff like this. So this is one thing that is impossible to do in Asia, and we are able to do it when we do it here. So for me, that was a big part of this project to control as much as I can and to learn as much as possible.
It's awesome. And I love the amount of kind of detail and focus that you've put into not just the bike, but the manufacturing processes, the environmental side of things. There's clearly a huge amount of thought that's gone into every element of what you're doing there. I'm interested in a lot of it, but one area that I kind of want to discuss a little bit is why carbon fiber? So it's obviously the material that you've chosen. It's still got that kind of exotic and desirable feel to it, but you know, you must have thought about the alternative, steel and aluminium. Why is carbon your preferred material to work in?
Well, basically the properties of the material. I mean, steel, I would say, is out of the question nowadays. The quality, like the properties of steel are pretty bad for bicycles at least. And the aluminium, it's definitely not as strong as carbon fiber. It doesn't give you as much freedom as carbon fiber does. So for me, was also high-end bikes are made of carbon fiber, but definitely the properties of the material are way better than aluminium. So that was kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah. And what sort of properties are you really interested in when you're choosing a material? Are there particular things that are key?
Well, basically you can fine tune a lot, your strength of the, like the strength of the bike, the stiffness of the bike. You can go quite light, lighter than aluminium. You cannot go crazy, insanely lighter, but you can definitely go much lighter than aluminum. So I think all of this is advantages. And another important one is that makes it easier to improve the bike. So it makes it harder initially to design it, but after in aluminium, if you, for some reason, I don't know, decide your tube's going to be 2 millimeter thickness, and then you want to change for 1.6 or 1.8 or something, you need a new mold and the whole process again, it's really slow. While on carbon, it's so easy to change the layup. So we're able to do a new bike every 2 days, 3 days. We can do a new front triangle and put a different layup and have different properties and look for different things. So it gives you that freedom to play around. Also, you can change materials much easier. So you can go for a much stiffer material or a stronger material or different options. And if depending on what you want to achieve. So it gave you this extra freedom. But on top of that, it's just a much better material to do a bicycle.
Yeah. And how much kind of iteration have you done in the design? I assume you do quite a lot of upfront kind of computer aided analysis work to get close to where you want to be, but does it ultimately come down to building something and going and trying it and then making changes?
Yeah, with carbon fiber, at least back in the day when we started, this was 3 years ago or even more now. We didn't have those so many tools to simulate the layups on the computer. And so everything has been done like by trial and error. So we have a pretty big pile of destroyed frames on the process. So it was a lot of learning. Also, we had no know-how. So whatever Asia has been doing in the past 10 years of carbon bike development, we have to learn in 3 years. So it's been hard, not easy, exhausting and frustrating, and it still is. But definitely we have learned a lot, and since a couple months now we're switched to a software where we're designing all the layups and everything on the computer. So slowly we're getting much better tools and big improvements against what we have initially. So it definitely in the future is going to be much easier, but until now it was really like trial and error and really not that much done on the computer except the design of the parts. So let's say that the testing and the refining has been done like old school braking stuff.
Yeah. But are you at the point now where you have a reasonable correlation between software and real life, or is that still something that needs to be evolved?
Yeah, it's not the correlation yet. So the simulation, we're doing very basic simulation. We're doing more the layup definition, but as we have quite a lot of data collected, we are able to make pretty good initial layups and not that much fine tuning after. But still, in the end, carbon fiber, it's a really manual process. So in the end, we end up testing everything after like with an actual working bicycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how much of your testing is kind of on the bike testing versus lab-based testing?
Well, I mean, when I'm referring mostly for testing, we have a big lab, like a lot of, we have 7 different fatigue jigs and 2 different impact testing. So there is a big part of the testing is there. And then the actual, let's say, timing or riding test, we do it usually with aluminium mules before starting. So before starting the carbon design or before opening the carbon mold. So basically all that's done before. But I'm going to be honest, I really don't time myself that much. Like I don't really test against clock that much, because over the years I found that to be pretty useless. And to me, the answer is very easy. And when I used to race professional, like in a World Cup, you have time practice, you have the qualify, and you have the finals. I tried to push myself as hell many times on time practice, and it was impossible for me to get closer to like plus 5 seconds. I always was at least 5 or more seconds faster on my qualify and my final run. So, you know, if it's not the pressure, I mean, when you're timing yourself, it's more about your motivation. It's like, do I feel today like really pushing? How much? Do you make a mistake? Then I chill a bit or whatever. Like when you're in race mode, you have this pressure. So that's where I think those timings are a bit useless. And it's very easy to demonstrate that they are useless. And the perfect example is 29er bikes last year. You heard all the teams and all the guys before the season. Yeah, we test, and some tracks we were like 3 seconds faster and this and that. And, you know, and you expected like the guys on 20, 29ers like to smoke everyone by 20 seconds. And that didn't happen. Still nowadays, not happening. I mean, Omri is winning on 29er, but I'm sure he will win on 26 inch bike. Either way, like, he's really fast, but Wynn has been winning on 27.5, no problem. And I'm sure all these guys have tested 29er, and really, it might be a second faster sometimes, second and a half, but that means nothing actually on race mode, because as you see on many races, any mistake, you go 1 second higher or lower. So for them, for me, it's all about being comfortable on the bike, because a bike that is 1 second faster, if in the end you're not so comfortable with it, because whatever is the reason, you don't like 29ers, it's just a psychological, like Luke Bruni, he hates 29ers. So, you know, for him, he probably it's slower, because he might end up doing more mistakes on a 29, even if the clock, when he's like doing perfect rounds and everything at home. So for me, like I was saying, is like the clock is pretty useless on downhill. It's more about the feeling you have on the bike, how many runs you can do, like keeping yourself in the line. And it's more about the feeling of it. To be able to push, that's only happening on a race run. Other than that, it's difficult to compare. So for me, every time, this is funny because, you know, like when I used to Strava, every time I was jumping in a new bike, I was able to beat my time. Doesn't matter if it was going to a 29er, then a 27, then shorter, a bit shorter travel, a bit longer travel. Because you know more the track, you know, whatever, and you could always keep pushing. So that to me is really difficult and doesn't really tell much. And I think if you base it completely on the clock, you might be misleaded. So and this also comes from something that Fabian Burrell told me when we were starting to develop the downhill bike with him, and he was telling me, like, you know, every year he was trying to like build rougher tracks to train, and he was putting harder the suspension on the off season, but in the end, it didn't matter anything, because he went to a first race and suddenly the pace was so much higher that the suspension was too soft and stuff like that. So pretty much he didn't have to throw all the settings away, but the pace was much higher at the race that nothing really helped. So, you know, last year in Leogan, you had all these teams suddenly pulling out all the 29er bikes, and because they tested at some point at home and in their local track, when it was a bit flatter, a bit more bike parkish, they were 2 seconds faster or 1 second faster or whatever. They thought they could arrive there and just do the same. But as a World Cup, the pace is so different, the level is much higher and the pressure. So they're not riding at the same pace. And it's not the same to ride a final race on the bike or just try to push for one run. You're not risking the same. So this means that you're not taking the bike to your actual limit. You make me maybe going to 90% of your limit, maybe 100 if you're pretty crazy, but on a race run you usually go over that limit most of the times. So that's the only way if you want to try win a race nowadays. So I think that's when really the mistakes start to happen. So when those guys went there and like they spend the whole year riding on 27.5 tires, 27.5 wheels, 27.5 fork, 27.5 frame with their own stiffness, rigidity, characteristics, and they change into something and test it for 2 days on that race and expect to have the same level. I mean, for me, it was silly. How a professional guy that dedicates a whole year to train with one specific bicycle to know exactly those tires, because, you know, most downhill riders, they love, I don't know, is it the High Roller or the Minion rear or whatever. They have the preferred tire that they try to use all they can if the conditions allow. So they change everything else and they expect to be as fast as they were on another bike. It was everyone that switched to 29er had the worst race of the year with that bike. And then they went back suddenly to the other one. And that's, to me, this goes back to basically your question about the longer geometry. So I think, you know, it's very easy to pull a good time on that bike in your local trail, but I would really love to see a single person backing up that with actual results. And that doesn't happen yet, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, really, it's really interesting. I never heard anyone talk about it in that way, but when you do, it makes a lot of sense. So you obviously, you know, you believe in in doing your testing work based on kind of the feel and the comfort and the fun of the bike, there's a lot of data acquisition systems now on the World Cup circuit. What are your thoughts on that, given the, you know, the complexity of those systems and the amount of data that's being looked at? Do you think it's beneficial to the riders, or do you think it's maybe creating problems?
So I would say that first of all, like we have data acquisitions, and we used it a couple of times, but mostly the most use we've been doing for it is just to know about the actual loads of using the bike. So it's not really like to help set up the suspension. And to me, that just helps to understand a bit what's going on in the bicycle. And what I mean, what's going on is, like, for the suspension guys, it's about the speed the fork and the shock is moving, so they could understand about the damping and fine tuning. So really, for the guys like RockShox or Fox or whoever, it's very important to know this data, like the speed the suspension is moving. Yeah. That is not really important for setting up your bike. It's really for the suspension guys. And then for the bike designers, it's important to understand a bit what's going on in the bike. Like, how is the bike sitting in a steep part of the track? How is the bike sitting in a flat corner or in a steep corner or in braking bumps? What's going on? But you cannot actually use it like you do in MotoGP. Basically, in a studio, we have one of the best engineers, chassis engineers for MotoGP. And he basically has worked for Marc Marquez and many guys, and now he's actually working on the development team for KTM in MotoGP. And he has over 30 years of data acquisition on his back. So I would say this is a really a guru. And we talk a lot, and we have a lot of discussions about geometry and stuff like that. And basically, for a MotoGP, it makes a lot of sense to have data recording, because the guy actually with the motorcycle is being able to go exactly on the same place every single time. And when I talk the same place, it's like 5 centimeters left and right, to brake pretty much in the exact same spot. But this on downhill or motocross or enduro motorcycle or enduro whatever bike, it's not the case. On downhill, every run, it's so many times between, so many guys have, the track is not, it's different. This could be a rock. So you cannot use the data recording as it's meant to be. That is to study small portions of the track, really, like, okay, let's see what happens in the entry of the corner. Let's see, okay, you're using the brake too much or too deep in the corner. You should release the brake earlier, or you have too much speed in the entry of the corner. This is what it's meant to be, but you cannot do this in downhill, because you just hit a rock me corner and everything blows out, and it's like, okay, what the hell happened here? And you don't even, the guy cannot remember every single corner from top to bottom of the track if he has hit a rock or if they were like a new line or whatever. So I think it's not useless, but it's not helping that much. And it hasn't shown in the results. Like, the guys using data, they really haven't done anything better than the guys without. It's not an advantage. On the other hand, if you see a guy going MotoGP without data, he won't be able to, like, even with the best bike, to do decent, because it's so accurate. So we go back to the same thing I was saying before. It's a lot about your feeling, about how you feel on the bike. The data helps you to understand what's going on with a certain rider. So you are able to see when he does like 3 or 4 runs to understand, okay, your fork is diving too much, we need to go stiffer. But you cannot go like actually and say, for that corner, we need half a click more here, or we need more offset because, you know, it's chattering the front end or whatever is happening there. So it's more to get an overall picture to understand and say, okay, get me a couple of runs, I'm going to set your bike and we take it off and that's it. I don't really know how deep they go when they use it. Maybe they just go for this to get just an overall picture. But to me, that's the only thing you can do. But if the rider has some feeling and understands what he's looking for, this is pretty easy to achieve without the data recording. So it's not so important for me to have it on.
Yeah, and that seems to be the way. Certainly riders like Aaron Gwynn seem to be able to know what they need to change. They don't need to have the data there to do it. So
yeah, and downhill is
sorry, and downhill is a bit like other sports, like motocross and stuff like that, where what you want is to get used to the bike and not change it too much. So in MotoGP, they change completely from track to track. Everything, they change the gearbox, they change so the gears are longer or shorter, depending on the corner speed, so they don't need to switch gears mid-corner. So the bike changes completely in MotoGP from one race to another. But on motocross, on downhill, you want pretty much the same setup because you got used to that suspension feeling. Because when you are on the asphalt, the ground has always the same feeling. So it doesn't really change from corner to corner. It just changes from track to track, but it's very constant. On downhill, from corner to corner, your grip changes completely. So the less you change the bike, the easier for you is to get used to the changing grip on the ground. So I think it's very different. So those tools, for me, they're not useless. They definitely are helpful in the off-season. They're helpful to let your rider understand a bit more what's going on the bike if he doesn't know. So I think it depends a lot on the rider. The data recording. Yeah. If your rider has problems to tell you the feedback or to understand what's going on, then you definitely need it a bit to understand. But I don't think it's something needed for every single race. And as I said, I don't think it makes any difference at all in the results of the guy.
Yeah, fair comment. I want to pick your brains a little bit on stiffness. So, you know, we've talked a bit about carbon fiber. You obviously use that in your bikes. There's a lot of kind of talk around making things lighter and stiffer, but you know, stiffness is not necessarily always a good thing, I think. And I think certainly from the MotoGP side of things, they seem to understand that quite well. So I was kind of interested in your thoughts on how you tailor the stiffness of the bike in the various kind of axes in order to, you know, get a product that can offer the best ride feel and the best grip.
Yeah, basically the stiffness, I would say, is very stiff. It's bad. It's very bad. I would say it's way worse to be too stiff than too soft. Maybe if you're doing a cross-country bike, it's a different story because you really want to put all the power. And this, basically, here before working on the bicycle industry, I work on MotoGP, basically doing simulation and stiffness simulation for 4 years. So all what I was doing is just fine-tuning stiffness of chassis and swing arms to find different behaviors. And basically what happens when you're leaning in the corner or turning, this is more extreme, of course, because of the lean angle of a MotoGP bike, but you just need to imagine that your suspension works only in one direction. Okay, let's say in the suspension direction. So, but the bumps are always vertical. So it hits in a vertical way. But when you're leaning, the suspension cannot absorb 100% of the bump because there's only a certain part of it that goes in the line of the suspension. The rest goes against the tire, the wheel, the fork, the chassis, you know, like, so when you're leaning extremely in MotoGP, basically the suspension is not what absorbs really the bumps, it's the chassis flex what absorbs it. So if you want to have traction, you need to have a chassis that can absorb lateral bumps and lateral movement. So if a bike is very, very stiff, when you're leaning in a corner and your bump hits your tire, let's say 80% or 70% goes into the suspension, but the rest goes into flexing the tire, flexing the wheel, flexing the chassis. If the chassis is super stiff, that cannot absorb any energy. So the energy needs to be absorbed by the tire, with tire deformation, and the wheel by flexing the wheel. Now, if you switch to carbon wheels, that stiffness also goes high. So who's in the end getting all the loads, all the deformation? Your tire. When your tire deforms, it loses the shape and you lose traction. So definitely we did a big, big effort initially to fine tune like the stiffness of our bike. What we found out really is like the correlation in between aluminium and carbon bikes was really basically in between torsion and lateral stiffness. It was a huge offset in between a bicycle made of carbon or aluminium. And that was what it made the feeling very different in between a carbon and an aluminium. In a certain way, they were very close to each other. But in another one, one was way more stiff. So, and this is where we really did a lot of effort. So we did put a lot of effort in our layup to make our bike less stiff, basically laterally, than and more torsionally was where aluminum was really good. So for us, we put a lot of effort and tried to mimic the same ratio. So the same ratio in between lateral to torsional stiffness. Still, we ended up, because due to the material, our bike is a bit more stiff than an aluminum one, but the ratio is very similar. So in the end, and basically when we made the downhill bike, one of the first ones, jumping from an alloy bike to the carbon one was not really a bit, for me, it was very easy. I went, like, when I raced the Master World Champs, I just got the bike the week before, and it was my first time in my entire life that I rode a carbon fiber bike. And I was, from day one, much faster than on the alloy one. And, I mean, definitely much faster, because I guess also, as I said before, motivation helps, and the bike was an upgrade as well, I would say, from what I had before. But it definitely, I felt at home from the first moment. I didn't feel like I had to get used to it. And when guys started switching from alloy to carbon in downhill, you heard a lot of guys. And I think Stiffbit was in front of those guys. He struggled for a couple of years until he got used to the carbon bike. So I think that made a big difference. But as you mentioned, and as I said, for me, more stiff, it's way worse. Even if, you know, all marketing goes for stiffer and whatever, I think that if you're creating a cross-country bike, I would say, okay, it makes sense, because the more stiff, the more power you transmit to the ground. But you don't win downhill races by transmitting more pedaling power to the ground. You win downhill races having more grip.
Yeah. So I was speaking to a couple of the mechanics up at the Fort William World Cup, having a look around the pits, and a number of the guys were running sort of relatively narrow, in the modern world anyway, rims with quite low spoke tension. And I guess the thinking was that, or the commentary from the mechanics was that allows the tire to deform in a more favorable way and retain more grip in those conditions that you're talking about. Have you got any thoughts on that? Because we've had this conversation with a few friends, and we've not quite managed to get our heads around whether that's a good thing or not.
I mean, for me, definitely the spoke tension is something you can play around to fine tune a bit the stiffness of your wheel. So this depends a lot. Like, we, for instance, we're running this Crank Brother prototype wheels where they have a smaller profile, so it makes them less stiff. So I guess we don't have that problem of having to run like less pressure, less tension on the spokes. But regarding to the tire, I completely disagree, because what you don't want is your tire deforming. You don't want to, like, what they're basically doing is like, okay, our frame is too stiff, it cannot do the job. Let's make the tire do the tire job plus the frame job. So it's doing two jobs now. So what this means is your tire is just deforming. So it's not supposed to be touching on the side knobs. It's only when it gets deformed, it's touching on the central knobs and on the side knobs again. And you know, like, your grip and your feeling is changing constantly. What you want really, and I'm really in favor of wide rims, and hopefully sooner someone can make like lower sidewall, like shorter sidewall tires. And what I'm in favor is like more the motocross style, or where your tires are a bit lower and more stiff, so you can run a bit lower pressure and reduce deformation. So, and because I think I see downhill closer to motocross probably than I see it to enduro on a motorcycle. Enduro, they really need traction on the back, so they still ride this pretty big tire on the back because they need to go through rocks and a lot of traction and a lot of tire deformation. But downhill is more about raw speed, so I think it's closer to motocross, where they run like low profile. And basically on motocross, you run under 1 PSI on the back, but you really need a stiff carcass. And I think that's what it's needed. So for me, like, the wider rims make a lot of sense, and I really don't agree to what these guys think about, you know, narrower rims to have the tire deforming more, because I think just makes it more difficult to understand and to predict what's going to happen. Because if you basically put a lot of load, your tire deforms, and you know what happens is when you hit a berm. When you hit a berm, the tire deforms, and you're basically, you know, gripping with the Maxxis logo, not really with the knob. So I don't really see any sense in that. What you want is the tire to actually work like it was designed. If you put certain knobs on the side of the tire to grip when you're turning, why you want the central knobs to be touching, or basically the knobs from the other side of the tire touching as the tire is so deformed? It makes zero sense. So,
Yeah. So a stiffer, lower profile tire to kind of counteract that with the right rim would be the way to head.
So for me, it's a stiffer tire in the carcass, but it's not a stiffer feeling to the tire. Let's say what I mean with this is stiffer tire with less pressure. So you have the same overall stiffness, but with less pressure inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's more closer to like motocross or motorcycle tires where they run at lower pressures. Basically, but the problem there is the weight, of course. It's always going to be the weight issue, because you will need more material on the tire to make it stiffer, and it's a rolling mass, so, you know, it's always a compromise. So,
And do you think, sorry, go on.
No, that's it.
I was just going to say, do you think we'll ever fix the age-old problem of punctures? I mean, it's you know, 30 years I've been watching downhill mountain biking, I guess, and it's the one problem that we don't seem to have got beyond.
I mean, you would never solve it completely. I mean, yes, you can put a mousse inside, but as we're not able to run on low pressure, it will never work, because a mousse, it just basically fills inside, not with air but just with material. So in motocross works the mousse, even if it's still not the same feeling, but as a tire work with so little pressure, you can still fit it in and be okay. But the main problem is the weight of the tires. I mean, if someone comes with a double thickness tire like it is now, or triple, I'm sure it become less of a problem. It's just the tires are too thin for the amount of work they're taking. So you can try to make miracles, try to like work on inserts, work on things and have leak, but it's really it's never going to change if no one comes and puts more, basically more weight on the tire. But who's going to sell a tire that is heavier just to tell you that you might flat, 20%, 30% less or 40% less. So I think at the moment, no brand is really willing, even if I know Maxxis, I think I saw somewhere they have a prototype of a tire with a bit more reinforcement inside to try to avoid this, but a flat.
I think Syndicate have been using something along those lines.
Yeah. A flat tire is very easy. It's just you cut through a tire. So a very easy solution, if you cut through thrown thing, it's make it thicker. It will be harder to cut through it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, the solution. How much material you need to put? Maybe 20% more is enough to reduce 80% of the flats. It's difficult to tell you, but unfortunately, I cannot design tires, so I'm not involved into that. But if it was for me, I mean, I would start playing with a bit heavier tires. In the end, you're putting these protectors and these foams inside that they add weight. Okay, add that weight to the tire. It's going to be way more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully someone wakes up and does something.
maybe one day. So let's talk about this year's buzz, I guess. So last year there was a lot of talk about 29ers, and this year there's been a lot of focus on high pivot idler suspension design, and particularly the Commensal with Amory and a number of other riders putting in some good results on it. It's not a new suspension design, it's something that's been out there for a while. Have you got any thoughts on why we're suddenly seeing it out there getting these results and getting so much attention? Is it kind of what Commensal have done elsewhere on the bike that have made that design work? Is it just that these riders are coming into form and they could do it on any bike? Have you got any thoughts on it?
I mean, to be honest, I only tried once high people bike. It was for two runs only, so there's not much I can say other than I feel weird to me, but it's hard to get used. But it was weird because it's different. It's not weird because it's bad. It was weird just because you need to get used to like the bike becoming longer and shorter pretty extremely. And that's the main issue of all the high pivot. And that's why you know, there's people that want to go that direction or they're a bit afraid because, you know, your geometry changes a lot from let's say, braking on a corner where the bike becomes short or really sitting in a corner or in a berm where the bike becomes really long. But it definitely, it's much better for bump absorption and stuff like that. But to say Amari would have done better with another bike or the same, it's very difficult. To me, I would say that guy is really good. I mean, like, that guy has a lot of skills on a bicycle. He probably would do good on any bike. But again, I don't know. I mean, if you look in the track, the bikes, what I'm going to say, but when you talk to the mechanics and other riders, our bike now, the rumors are basically that it's the best working bike out there in the World Cup. Like, we have so many other racers telling, like, wow, the bike looks really good on the track. And if you watch it to any World Cup, just check a place where it's rough and check our bike and other bikes. So it's difficult to say. For me, I think it's the riders. They just got a couple of really good riders, and that's pretty much it, because we go to the same thing. Still, you know, Aaron Wynn hasn't been in good form on the last races, unfortunately, with his injury. So would have Amari win any races if Wynn would have been on his top form? I don't know. I know Remy Tiron, he was much faster with the old school bike than with the high pivot. He never did really good on it. So, you know, it's difficult to say. It's difficult. Also, our bike is a virtual pivot, and basically how it works and how our system is, in the very first part until the sack point, our bike, it's pretty much like a high pivot. Like the pivot, like the central, the instant rotation center is really high. So our bike is really like a high pivot on the first part of the travel from 0 to 30% for the small bumps and the braking bumps. So acts like a high pivot. And for the rest, it's just like a normal bike. And then past the sack point, it starts becoming like a really low pivot. And lower the deeper in the travel. So this means that there's less chain tension and there's more freedom. But so still, like I said, it's one of those things that it's very difficult. And I don't really have the information to tell you if it's good or not. The only thing I can tell you is our bike is kind of a mix of a high pivot in the first part of the stroke to a normal or efficient pivot around the sack, 32-45%, and past that becomes a low pivot that it's good for small chain tension or low chain tension.
I had a look at Greg Williamson's bike up at Fort William, and it is a very beautiful thing. How's it going? You've got Greg and Taylor Vernon on the team. Are they helping kind of with development of the bike, or are you all happy with where it is?
Well, they've helped a lot, basically, in the sense of putting proper roughness on it. So when we started the season, we had a couple problems. We basically broke two bikes, and that we thought like, oh, we are good and our layup is fine. But you know, when we started like getting really rough and like really extreme stuff, and they put quite a lot of hours, we found a couple weak spots. But the good thing is that, you know, like a week after, we went back, we redefined the layup, and no problems happened since then, fingers crossed. And they are on, and that's basically the reason that we delayed a bit the sale of the bike. This is something that no other brand can do. Like the other brands, when they probably find the issue, it's too late because they already hit the production. So for us, we were able to save it. So it really, it's very, very useful in terms of learning and seeing things and making improvements for the future. So they're really helpful in a sense of like putting hours in the product and rough hours like racing, where, you know, like you just don't care about the bike. It's like, hey, I just want to go fast.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're both looking good. There's some bad luck I think they've had this season, yeah. But some serious pace when they've been going well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been not very lucky. Like this. Yeah. In Val di Sole with the rain. Well, in Fort William, he hit the rock and bent the rotor, and basically was pushing the pads every time the bent part of the rotor was going through the pads, was pushing the pistons out, but he hit the rotor like pretty extreme. So it was like proper, mm-hmm. like really, really bent. So nothing to do there. It's just one of those things that he probably slipped a bit, hit the rock, and unfortunate. Then Val di Sole just bad luck with the rain and they crashed and yeah, and basically a lot of guys got out in Val di Sole and here he had a flat tire and yeah. So
yeah, but yeah, the pace is clearly there, so fingers crossed for a bit of better luck towards the end of the season.
Yeah, hopefully he can have some good luck a good race. I think he doesn't need luck. I think they have put the time and the hours, so he just needs to get it together.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, we're getting pretty close to the end of our time. We've got three questions that we've asked all our guests, so I'd definitely like to ask you those. And
yeah,
I've got two other quick ones that I'm kind of interested in your take on. The first one is, you know, as a sport, what do you think mountain biking's doing well at the moment?
What? In just as a sport sense, or
yeah, in anything in the you know, the product or the racing or the sport or, you know, any element of it really, what do you think's going well for mountain biking at the moment?
Well, I mean it's a difficult question, I would say. For me, I mean, yeah, if I think about myself, what mountain bike feels good for me, it's a way to like free my mind. It's like my psychoanalysis, like where I need to talk to someone. I just go on a bike ride or too stressed. But in more terms of the industry, I think, you know, still is a lot going on, new materials, new stuff, sometimes too much in terms of standards, and something that I'm not really happy with, because it makes it hard for small brands, and something I feel like the big brands love pushing, so the small mm-hmm. guys cannot keep up with them, and they kill some of them on the way, so makes it cleaner. But I guess, you know, it's a jungle out there. But
yeah, for sure.
E-bikes is a bit of, I really like e-bikes, but on the other hand, I'm a bit scared of e-bikes because it's making the mountains overcrowded. And I'm scared, like it happened at least where here near Barcelona. I used to go, when I was a kid, I went on a trials bike to ride like a trials motorcycle to go on the mountain, and you could go enduro and everything. But at some point, enduro on the motorcycle became super popular. So they stopped banning mm-hmm. to ride on the mountain, until now it's completely prohibited. So I'm a bit afraid that e-bikes are going to bring banning of mountain bikes in the mountain, because where I live now, 50% of the guys I see, they're on e-bikes, and it's growing and growing. So my fear is a bit that it's going to overcrowd the mountains. It's some guys with no skills going into difficult tracks, getting probably injured there, then, you know, need to send a helicopter or whatever to pick the guy. And might happen sooner or later that we're gonna all be punished, because not because of the e-bikes, but because of the fact that make easy for anyone to go anywhere nowadays on a mountain bike, that I think it's good. But on the other hand, if I'm a bit selfish, I don't like it so much, because it's somehow might end up with none of us being able to ride bikes anymore.
Yeah.
So it's,
I totally share your concerns on that. I think there's some kind of agreement or legislation or some thought that needs to go into the trail usage side of things to make sure yeah, that the access that we have kind of remains, and that there's the relevant agreements in place.
Yeah, yeah,
it has the potential to blow up.
Yeah, that to me is, that's a bit scary, and but as I said, I love it. I mean, I have a lot of fun. I use one now, not that much anymore. I'm riding more like a pedal bike, but still we develop bikes for the brands, and we develop a couple of e-bikes, so I have to ride them, and I really enjoyed it. But also, there's another part that makes it very dangerous to me, is that I tend to climb to from trails that I can go down. So before, pretty much, you know, like which trails were pretty much one direction, and nowadays they turn a lot of trails both directions if they're not really difficult. So this means that also becomes way dangerous, because you have a lot of chances that where you're going flat out down whatever trail, there's a guy on an e-bike pedaling up. Because I'm doing that. I mean, I'm pedaling like, oh, I hope today no one's coming flat out here, because I'm just pedaling on the track.
Yeah, it's definitely going to take a few years, I think, for it all to settle down. But yeah, hopefully it goes in a good direction and doesn't cause too many problems, because they're here to stay for sure. And
yeah,
definitely
a
good part of mountain biking. But yeah, it needs some thought.
Yeah, definitely. It's clear.
Cool. Alrighty, and then our standard questions that we end all of our episodes with. The first one is, if our listeners had £100, so that's probably pretty similar in euros, 110 euros maybe, to improve their performance on a bike.
Say it again.
What would you recommend?
Can you say it again? Sorry.
Yeah. If our listeners had £100 to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend that money on? It could be literally anything.
£100. Tires.
Okay. And do you have a favorite tire that you would recommend?
Wow. I'm for enduro, I'm pretty happy with the High Roller side right now. High Roller 2.
Okay. Which casing? Because there's so many different casings available, isn't there? And compounds.
Yeah. Tell you the truth, I have no idea which ones I'm riding. I'm gonna be honest.
Excellent. Do you know what pressure you
a
run?
Lot of pressure, because I want to avoid, like, I ride like 2.5 kilos on front and 3 on the back. I hate having flats, and I'm not running tubeless right now because I dented one rim and I'm on a tube.
Yeah.
So I put a lot of pressure. I hate having flats, and I'm a disaster. So I'm one of those guys that never carries a camera or anything. I mean, yeah. So yeah, for riding around, I mean, when I go to, like, if I go with the friends and we go to ride to like this here nearby, like proper tracks to do enduro, then I put usually 1.8, 2.2 on the back, and similar to downhill, maybe 2.2 on the back as well. Depends also the type of track and the chances. But last year I was riding Whistler and I was 3 kilo on the front and 3 kilo on the back, just because I was riding like rocky stuff, and I didn't want like to have to go to the apartment because I had a flat tire or whatever, and also didn't want to break the rim or whatever. So it just depends. I mean, one thing is, if I go to like actually race mode, I put proper pressures. If I go to like, I just want to ride and have fun, I don't care that much. I just put something that will make sure that I go back home without pushing the bike with a flat tire.
Yeah, definitely a good thing to avoid. Good stuff. Then the next question, if you could wind back the clock and have a sit down with yourself aged 16, what advice would you give him?
I think, yeah, now I learned a lot through the years how hard things are and how much you need to fight for what you want. And when I used to race, I think everything came so natural that I really never put that much effort into it. And I wish that I knew what I know now. Like, you really need to, like, you know, if you have a skill or something, or if you like something, really like push and go for it. Like, when I trained more when I raced Master World Champs than when I used to train as professional.
Really? But just because you're kind of, because of the life lessons you'd learned between the original race career and then?
Well, yeah, basically there, I mean, I was a kid and, you know, like I was studying and I was coming home and it's like, oh shit, now I need to go train and this. And then I, like, some days I was going out and I remember I was just going out and I was going, a friend lived nearby and I went to his house and it's like, came back 2 hours later and I did my training and but I didn't do anything at all. I, like, 10 minutes of bike riding and just spend the whole time in a friend's house. So, but yeah, and when I raced Masters or in fact, I raced World Cups again in 2009. I raced that year and I still, I think I managed to get two top 30s after many, like in 2002 that I didn't race. So, but then I was working full time and I was going at 9 p.m. to a velodrome in Barcelona every day, riding the velodrome at night for 1 hour and a half, half an hour sprints, whatever, and then to the gym, arriving past midnight every day. And then day after, alarm, 6 a.m., work, then. So, you know, I wasn't doing that. And for the Masters was a similar story. I was, we started work at 7 in the morning. So I left home. I wake up every day, 5:36. I was leaving work maybe, or, well, not leaving work, but leaving the work with the bicycle at 5, doing 2 hours bike ride, you know, sprints, whatever, then coming back. And then on the weekends, every single day, I was waking up, same thing, at 6 a.m. on a Saturday and a Sunday, drive to a bike park, train, and then go back home, and then driving, the bike parks here, the closest is 2 hours, in between 2 hours, 3 hours, depending where I was going each way. So I was doing that every single day. I have to say that I only trained for the Masters World Champ for 2.5 months. It's not that I trained for that long, but there's no way I would have been doing this when I was so young. So I really have learned how much you need to fight for what you want, and that, you know, with effort, you can overcome so many skills that you might lack of. So definitely this is a big lesson, but it's one of those lessons that I guess the only way to learn them is just by going through them in life. You know, it's like, it's not, I don't think it's something you can see the kid and tell, like, or tell myself, yeah, you need to, like, you know, fight more for things and value more and all that stuff. I think is one of those things that actually you, life teaches you.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you. I really like that. And then the last question is a bit of fun. If you could have a coaching session from any rider, past or present, who would it be, why, and what would you want to learn from them?
To me, it would definitely be Nico Buio. Like, he was my favorite rider. It's always been my favorite rider. Win, I would say it's pretty close to it. I think how he tackles the training and everything, it's pretty crazy, because he never goes, like, he just cruises the track and then suddenly he can go, like, flat out and smoke everyone. I think that's insane. But what Nico did and his mental game was over anyone ever will be, like, to be able to win 10 world championships. I think it's crazy. I mean, Win doesn't even have one and he has 10 of them. To me, that was unbelievable what that guy did, and you know, so yeah, I think for me, he will be the guy that I would like to learn. Also, his technique, he was so smooth, and to me, was a guy that I always looked for, like, to try to mimic what he was doing. I mean, I would never got close to it, but he always impressed me, and I also got, well, we've met quite a few times and we talk from time to time, so it's pretty cool as well that I'm able to talk to him, but definitely, he's been my favorite guy ever.
Awesome. Yeah, very, very special rider, something that I think we'll wait a long time to see repeated, if ever. So
and very, the fact that he retired pretty young too. Like, it's not that he pushed that far, really. I mean, he I don't know if he's the same age or even younger than Steve Pete, and he retired Well, I think we pretty much retired at the same time. I think it was 2002 when he retired, or 2001.
Yeah, he's been out of downhill. Yeah, been a long time since he left downhill. So yeah, fair play. Okie dokes. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting. Super interesting. If people want to find out a little bit more about what you guys are doing with Uno, where can they find you? Where's the best place to head?
Yeah, well, the website, definitely you have more about the bikes, but definitely on Instagram is where probably we get more the insights and stuff. And we're always open, like if people ask things to show more what happens behind the cameras, we are pretty transparent and we like sharing what we do, because I think the fact that we do everything in-house, it's pretty cool. So, yeah, I think in there. Awesome. Either.
And that's at Ride Uno on Instagram, is that right?
Yeah, and uno.com cool. on the website.
Yeah, we'll put some links in the show notes as well, so people can find those over on our website.
Perfect.
Good stuff. Well, thanks a lot for your time. Really enjoyed chatting. I hope everything goes well with Uno and with the team for the rest of the season. And thanks a lot.
Yeah, there's just one thing that I remember. It's not important, but one thing that we didn't touch that I think was also interesting was the fact of, you know, the there's been a lot of talking about carbon fiber being super dirty versus like aluminium super clean. And that might be able to do for a complete podcast version too. But I think that's something interesting because it's so misleading. We're doing some research from our side for our website. We will have like a page of environmental facts and stuff. And I'm trying to do it actually professional, not like, oh yeah, the carbon manufacturers in Asia throw it in the ocean. But I really don't care about Asia, because I think we are different, completely different animals. So we're not aluminium manufacturer in Asia. We're not carbon fiber manufacturer in Asia, but we are like Spain or Europe manufacturing carbon fiber. But still, you know, there's a couple of brands that have talked really bad about carbon fiber without really looking at actually how aluminium is extracted, and the pollution and everything, and the energy you actually need to like melt that aluminium, and the fact that not a single bike is made out of recycled material. So in the end, what's the point if you recycle if you don't use it?
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
And you guys are working quite hard on kind of like lifetime warranties for the frames and things, and trying to make a product that lives for a long time rather than something that's disposed after a season or so, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that in the end, it's difficult to tell because you can also crash and break it. But we work with the only certified Spanish carbon recycling company. So all our material that we cut and is not used, because unfortunately, when you cut, there's some material that you don't use, goes for recycling. We are working on a project to use recycled carbon fiber. So there's two types of recycling on the carbon fiber: the raw material or the non-cured material, or the cured material. With the non-cured material, you can still use it for parts very easy. So you just chopped it into pieces and then like compact. So we are looking in the future to make like chainstay protectors or other small parts that they don't need structural out of the recycled fiber that we don't use in our process. And actually all this fiber, we are keeping it in our fridges, so we don't throw it away. And then every single frame that we have broken during all the tests, and also some frames that get discarded, this, we keep it as well in the workshop. And once a year, this company that, as I said, is the only Spanish company certified that does carbon fiber recycling, comes and picks it up. But also, And this for us is very important, even if every frame we pay 60 euros for this recycling of the frame. So it's not that they take it and give you some money. It's like you need to actually pay for it. But for us, this is very important. But this company, basically, the project comes from an Airbus project. So this company was born due to a Airbus need to do something with all their carbon fiber waste. And basically, what they're actually doing with the waste material is the interior of the plane. So they use it for panels, like back seats, side walls, and different like that. So it's actually being reused. And to me, what is really interesting and you know, is that actually to recycle carbon fiber, the amount of energy you need is way, way, way lower than what you need to melt aluminium. And it's infinitely much cleaner generating carbon fiber than aluminium. What it's clear is none of them is a clean material, and that doesn't exist. Carbon comes from petroleum.
It's perfect.
Aluminium comes from dirt. To me, the big difference is that aluminium really, if you look at the extraction process, it's really, it's digging a hole in the earth, open mining, and the melting like requires some of the, like a kilo of aluminium requires a lot of raw dirt that needs to be like processed and separated to transform into 1 kilo. And this is what we're really looking exactly to understand and really tell what's cleaner. But actually, carbon fiber, it's not being banned from countries to be able to produce, but aluminium mining and this, it's going all to other countries like Africa or different ones, basically, because I think it was France and a couple more places where, and also Basque Country, they had a lot of aluminium mining, but it was so dirty and contaminating because you need to like trash the when you melt the materials to get the aluminium out of it, a lot of melted material that sits on top of the melted aluminium, you need to basically throw it in the same mine, and this filters through the dirt and then contaminates all the rivers and all the water that's under. So if you really Google aluminium mining and conversion and extracting and all that, you'll get pretty surprised how crazy dirty aluminium is. Like, it's insane. Yeah. And I'm not saying that carbon fiber is clean, because in the end it comes from petroleum and you know what can happen and with it. But in a way, the impact, I believe it's a bit lower than it is on aluminium. But anyway, what we're working is basically on get actual facts, not because what I'm saying is what I've have browsed a bit and learned to like check some documents and some videos and stuff like that. But actually I want to get proper data, backup data, and not talk like, people throw, carbon is super dirty, you cannot recycle. I mean, someone that tells you that carbon fiber, you cannot recycle is like, come on, you have no clue what you're talking about, really. So I was pretty shocked. Like, actually, a brand could say like something so stupid as that you can actually just go on Google and put carbon recycling, and there's like 20 companies that come up and tell you what they do with it. It's definitely an issue what to do with recycled material, but at least in Spain, this company has a solution for it, and Airbus has the need just to make lightweight. It's a substitute for plastic, for non-structural parts. So, because the problem of carbon fiber when you recycle it is really actually what you do is basically melt the resin so it doesn't need very high temperature, and you just get left with the fiber itself that you chop and whatever and do a new part on it. So the problem you have is that you actually have high modulus fiber with intermediate modulus, with low modulus, everything mixed. So you actually don't control the properties of the part. So you cannot use it for structural, but you can use it for many other lightweight parts.
Yeah, for a cosmetic part, then it's
basically
it's good enough.
Yeah, it's all the interior of a plane. So for them, there's a lot of use for it.
Yeah. No, it's cool. And it's irrespective of which comes out on top, I think the key thing is that people like yourself understand, want to get into the detail of it and care about the footprint of what you're creating. I think that's the main thing. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
I like the way you guys are looking at it.
For us, it's very important. It's cool. This and I think anyway, we are miles ahead of anything that happens in Asia, call it aluminium, call it carbon. Like the controls they have there, our pain booth like completely recycles the air, so we don't throw the air outside. They have huge filters, the cabin, the painting booth, so it's pretty expensive, but the air doesn't go outside like where you do anywhere else, or pretty much any other painting booth is that way. So this is the type of cabin we have. It's painting booth. It's made for, is the one they use for trains, to paint trains, because actually they do it in the underground, or at least in Spain, a couple of companies, they do it in this company. Basically this type of cabin, it's made, ours is much smaller, but they only use it for trains. because they do it in the underground, so they really cannot have fresh air, and they will have to have pre-lung pipes. So what they do is just recycle the air and clean it. So, but yeah, as I said, for us, this is a very, very important part, and I want to be more and more important every year and push more for this.
Yeah, no, that's great stuff. Really good to hear. Well, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
It's been super interesting. And yeah, look forward to seeing how Uno progresses.
Thanks a lot.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening. If you did, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. Don't forget, if you want to try and win a top spec Cotic rocket, it's £5 an entry. You can enter as many times as you like. Just head to justgiving.com/fundraising/Cotic rocket raffle, or just head to justgiving.com and search for Cotic and it'll take you to the page. Okay, we'll have another great episode for you on the 28th of August, but until then, get out and ride.